From the studios of KUSP in Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Mick Houghton is my guest this week. He is a journalist and rock historian who has worked in the music business, and he's just written the definitive biography of the great vocalist and songwriter Sandy Denny. The book is I've Always Kept a Unicorn, The Biography of Sandy Denny. Mick Houghton, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Hello.
Sandy Denny is such a great voice, such a tragic story, and you really did a marvelous job of bringing her to life on the page, and congratulations for that.
Thank you. Well, it's a story that has everything, and I think she was a character that had everything, you know. It's a good place to start, really, isn't it? And I felt in a way that what I had to do was just to try and tell the story, because it's such a great story that one didn't need to embellish it too much, because it's there in her life, really, isn't it? So,
had you ever met her?
No, I never met her. I mean, I was lucky enough to see her play a number of times. I mean, first with Fairport, then with Fotheringay, and then a couple of solo shows. But I never met her. I mean, what's kind of interesting for me, you mentioned earlier that I've been in the industry. I've been largely as a publicist, and I guess where I've been lucky, and I think this helped a lot for me in writing the book, is that I worked and became good friends with people like Bert Jansch and John Renbourn and Richard Thompson. And I think that sort of helped, because I knew them. And I think when I spoke to them, and would often talk to them about Sandy, even before I was doing the book. So it just helped give me an insight into the times that she lived in, and into her life as well.
Mick Houghton, what made you decide to write this book now?
I mean, to some extent, I was actually involved with there's a big box set that came out. I think it was in 2007, the sort of 19 disc box set, and I was involved in that. I mean, I did the PR for it, and I did the interviews that we used in the booklet. And to be honest with you, it was something that Elizabeth Hurt, who runs Sandy's estate and Trevor Lucas's estate. I mean, she asked me one day, do you think anybody would be interested in another book on Sandy Denny? And I said, yes, I think it's about time. There hadn't been one since a proper biography since Clinton Hayden's book, which is in 2000. And I guess that sort of planted the seed for me to go away and think, well, yeah, why don't I do it? because it came at a time for me when I'm kind of winding down the PR side of what I do and wanted to write more. And what was extraordinary was, in a way, that I decided I wanted to do the book, and Elizabeth kind of gave it a blessing, although it's not an authorized book, but she's been very helpful. And I found a publisher immediately. Just from the idea of thinking I want to do this book, it became a reality very quickly. It then took 3 years to write, but I think that's the degree of research that was required, really.
Well, I'm glad it came together, because it's such a great book. And one of the things I love about the book is that it really places Sandy Denny in her time, with a lot of the other music that was happening at the same time. And also, you in the back, you put a really useful discography of other music that you can listen to, as well as the music that Sandy Denny made. And I love that. That was great. And
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because it was something that just I didn't expect to be as long as it was. I thought, let's not just have another discography, because you can get discographies online these days, so I wanted to do something that contextualized her music, the songs she covered, the other people that were around at the time, her friends and rivals. And suddenly this thing grew to I don't know, a lot more pages than I expected, But I was really pleased with it, and I thought it added to the context of her kind of life and career in a way that it was enabled me to get stuff in there that I couldn't put in the actual story because it would have held up the story, I think, and I think it's quite important to if you're doing a biography to to stick to the not to go off of too many tangents really.
Well, it's great because of course it's also cost me a lot of money because now I've been collecting some of those things that I didn't have, fleshing out my collection with some things, and I'm glad that you turned me on to them. You know, it's interesting how time has an effect on the way people view music and the artists who made it. For instance, Nick Drake was pretty much ignored when he was making music, and today he's revered, and Donovan was a huge star when he was making music, and today is pretty much ignored.
Yeah, and I guess, I guess in a fairly obvious way, I suppose with Donovan, I think few would disagree that he didn't peak at a certain time, and I think the music he's done subsequently hasn't lived up to his best work in the 60s and early 70s, and I guess with someone like Nick Drake and with Sandy Denny, you get a much more encapsulated career, don't you?
Because they died young.
I mean, what I find interesting with Sandy Denny is that I don't think she's revered in the same way as Nick Drake, say, and I think that's partly because her career took so many twists and turns, and I think you look at some of her later work, and people don't think it's as good as, people don't hold up the Rendezvous album as being one of her best albums. But it's still an interesting album because in a way I think she was in transition at that point. And obviously she died before she could follow the sort of directions she seemed to be heading with that album. And I think what was interesting with that album was I think she was exploring her songwriting as much as anything else. Whereas I think for most of her career, I think people did see Sandy Denny as a singer rather than a songwriter. And you talk about the context of time. I think it's only over time that people have come to appreciate what a great songwriter she was as well.
Every one of her records has some really interesting tracks, and some really beautiful songs. And also all of her albums have some songs that you wish that she hadn't bothered to record.
Yes, that's true. I've got a lot of stick for that because people say, I've said this in other interviews, that she never made the classic album that I think people would say someone like Nick Drake made, for example. And it's true, there was always, a certain amount of filler on her albums. And part of the reason for that was that she wasn't a prolific songwriter. She wasn't a Joni Mitchell, she didn't churn out songs. More often than not, when she went into the studio, she was two or three songs short of a finished album, if you like. I think that's the reason, that she ended up doing covers and including one or two songs that just weren't as good as didn't really capture her best, I don't think.
The idea of her covering "Candle in the Wind" sounds great, but then listening to her cover "Candle in the Wind" doesn't sound as great.
No, and I guess it's very unfortunate as well. I'm not overly fond of the song. I don't think it's a great version of the song, and obviously that song has become something else anyway, hasn't it? Over time, that song has kind of grown out of all proportion in terms of its importance. It's sort of a shame as well in that, fun enough, around the time of that last album, Rendezvous album, she was actually writing some great songs that she didn't, she didn't record, or she did record and she left off the album to make way for, an Elton John cover.
Time It Gets Dark, I think that's one of the greatest songs she ever wrote.
Yeah, and this "I'm a Dream" is a fantastic song. I think the problem with the final album was that I think she and Trevor, her husband and producer, were sort of trying too hard to, I think, to reposition themselves, and you know, and I think they knew their sort of days were numbered at Island Records. That time, you know, things were changing there, and that's what I mean about it. It was a record that was a sort of transitional, if you like. I think she was looking for a new direction, and you know, what's interesting is there's every chance that had she not died, she may well have gone to America. There was talk that she was going to go and live and work in America, and that might actually have been a better climate for the sort of music that she seemed to be pursuing at the end of her life.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like maybe if she'd come over here, she could have maybe gotten in with some of the people who were producing top-notch records at that time in a singer-songwriter vein, and you know, maybe things would have worked out.
And of course,
isn't that a frustrating? I'm sorry. Isn't that a frustrating aspect of her career? In fact, as I'm reading your book, I really felt this sadness, not just because her life ended so soon, but also because the time that she spent, so much of it was wasted or squandered. And I think a lot of the musicians in that era did a similar thing. They thought that their lives would go on forever, or their youth would last forever, or their recording careers and so forth. And I think a lot of those artists wasted a lot of their efforts.
No, I think you're right. I think and it's interesting that, we're talking about people that came out of folk music, if you like, out of a folk background. And to some extent, you look at some of the folk musicians in the 60s, like Sandy or Roy Harper. I mean, they actually led the kind of rock and roll lifestyle almost to a greater extent than rock and roll musicians were doing. You know, they burnt the candle at both ends, let's put it that way. And I think that comes as a surprise to people that because I think folk music, certainly in the 60s, had a much more kind of conservative and staid reputation, I guess. You know.
Yeah, you don't think of them as doing a lot of drugs and driving expensive
cars. No. You know, and I also think, you know, which I one of the other things I hope I brought out in the book was that some of those characters that she was hanging out with, when she was only 17 or 18 years old, when she was starting out in folk, they were real larger-than-life characters that, you know, like someone like Alex Campbell, who probably very few people have heard of, but you know, it's clear that Sandy, and I know from talking to people like Bert Jansen, John Renbourn, is that Alex Campbell was a huge figure in folk music, you know, really influential. And, you know, at the same time, you know, a real kind of wild card, you know, heavy drinking, Scotsman who everybody loved but, you know, didn't really fit in with the kind of new, with the way that folk music progressed after the mid 60s, and never really made a great record, but he influenced just about everybody. I mean, same goes for Jackson C. Frank, who, you know, Sandy obviously had a relationship with as well, another hugely influential figure who, you know, again, died in very tragic circumstances. It seems to be something about the folk music about folk music at that time that people did lead these very tragic lives and to some extent, as you put it, wasted lives. You know, even in the time when they were, you know, recording and playing around the clubs.
We're talking with Mick Houghton, and he's just written a great book about Sandy Denny called I've Always Kept a Unicorn, the biography of Sandy Denny. I'm Gary Shapiro. This is from the bookshelf. I recently saw Janice Ian performing, you know, the folk singer, American folk singer, and she had a big hit years ago with a song called At 17. And before she played the song, she said, you know, sometimes there are songwriters who have written one song that everybody knows and loves, and they want you to play it every single time. And that song, you know, when you've written a song like that that's really touched a lot of people, it's never a chore, and it's always a joy to play it for you, so here it is. But I guess Sandy Denny, who was associated with Who Knows Where the Time Goes endlessly as her, you know, most people think of it as her greatest song, and I guess it was a song that she was most well known for, but she didn't feel it was her best song? Did she resent performing it?
I think she was pretty ambivalent about it, but interestingly, you know, there was a period when she stopped performing it, but towards the end of her life, she was certainly performing it. And I mean, what's also interesting about people when they're associated with that one song, it seems to follow them around almost as well. And something I didn't realise till almost till I'd finished the book was the number of occasions when that song is just so significant. I mean, it was, you know, it was the last song that Fairport Convention recorded before the crash, so it was the last song that Fairport recorded with Martin, with the original drummer. Mm. You know, it was the last song that she performed when she did a little Village Hall gig a month or so before she died. It was the song she closed the set with. I think it was more in her case, I suppose, that she felt there were better songs that she'd written. And it's fair to say, and it's true to this day, I mean, none of her other songs have become as well known or particularly widely covered, which I find quite strange, actually, that people haven't covered more of her songs.
I don't think there's any song that anyone has written that is better than Who Knows Where the Time Goes.
Across the evening sky, all the birds are leaving. But how can they know it's time for them to go?
Sandy was almost close to leading a kind of rock and roll lifestyle, I suppose, during her life. I mean, I think, you know, you get the comparisons with Janis Joplin, which I don't think are quite accurate, but there's an element of that. You know, she did what the boys did, as quite a few people said about her, is that was her way of coping, was to, being in an industry where you were a woman surrounded by men, you know, she matched them, you know, drink for drink and smoke for smoke, whatever was going on.
Well, who knows where the time goes aside. I think millions and millions of people who have never heard the name Sandy Denny know her voice, at least, from the Led Zeppelin track Battle Forevermore on the Led Zeppelin. She's the only person ever to sing on a Led Zeppelin record other than Robert Plant. How did it come about that she sang on that record?
I think largely because she'd met them. I mean, she'd met them at a Melody Maker Awards party, because she won Best British Female Singer, and I think Robert Plant won Best Male Singer, and I think it was also significant. I think Led Zeppelin toppled the Beatles for the first time in a decade. Another group was voted Best Group, so she met them there, and I think got to know them, you know, just pretty well. But it was literally as simple as I think, you know, Robert Plant and Jimmy Page thinking, you know, we need another voice for this track. They were both huge fans of Fairport and the Incredible String Band and Pentangle. And I think they literally just rang her up and said, do you want to do this? And she said yes. She turned up at the session, which was done at Island Records, which she was very familiar with, Island Studios. As far as I can gather from people I've spoken to, it was done in one or two takes. It was over in about an hour, and that was that. It was done. And what is fascinating, I find, is that it was never really spoken about in her lifetime, particularly. It wasn't. It's become this enormous, you know, it's become enormously important now. But at the time, it wasn't seen as particularly significant that she sang on that track. And
well, time has also been very kind to Led Zeppelin. You know, I think at the time that record came out, Led Zeppelin fans loved it, but people who were fans of Sandy Denny were not necessarily people who were listening to Led Zeppelin.
Oh, no. And I think in this country, I think Led Zeppelin were not, you know, they were not flavor of the month here, certainly not with critics. I mean, largely because they spent most of their time
over here
in America. I mean you would know this better than me. I mean, I don't know if Sandy Denny is better known in America through the Led Zeppelin song, through Battle for Evermore, than she is here. I think here people know her for Fairport Convention and know her for Legion Leaf and Matty Groves, but I wonder if in America she's not better known because
I don't think they know her name, but I think they know that record probably better than I'm just saying the average rock fan.
It's a shame that it hasn't sent more of them scurrying to buy her records, actually.
Well, I mean, I was always a fan of Sandy Denny's and Fairport and all those people, but, you know, I'm a record collector. I'm a record junkie in the museum.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I mean, they did, Fairport, certainly during the time she was with them the second time around, they toured in America a lot, didn't they?
Right,
they played there a lot.
They played in a local club. I was living in L.A., and they played the Troubadour, which is right around the corner from my house.
Oh, right. Was this in the shows that they recorded?
That 74, I think it was.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a good... that recording is now available on the... It's like a bonus disc on the... On the last.
It's a bonus disc on the Rising for the Moon reissue.
Yeah.
And that band was, had its moments. I mean, I think they were pretty good. I think a lot. Again, it's another record, the Rising for the Moon album. It's another Sandy Denny album or Sandy Denny related album, but it is let down by some.
Not such great songs.
Some
of the songs
are awful songs.
Yeah, some of them are so great. Yeah,
I mean, so her stuff is great. I mean, the two, just three or four of her songs that are among her best, you know.
Yeah.
Although it's fair to say on Rising for the Moon that the bad songs are actually not written by her. So
right, that's right. So, you know, it's interesting because do you think that she had bad management, bad advice? Did she not have good grip on her art? What was the where did things go wrong for her?
I think all of the above, basically. She never really had good management. I don't think she had a particularly great sense of her own career because, you know, in a way she was so kind of riddled with the kind of mood swings about how good she was or not. And but at the same time, you know, I don't know that folk musicians in particular, or people that came out of a folk background, actually thought that much about careers. I mean, folk musicians, by and large, you know, they made their money by playing, and they, you know, that's what they did, and they were largely self-sufficient from being on the road. So, I don't think she was particularly well managed. And I mean, one of the things that I talk about in the book is that, she was signed to Island Records, which was a great label, but it wasn't a hands-on label. So, she was just pretty much left to get on with it herself. And I think. You know, at different times, you know, she made what are now perceived to be very, very poor decisions about producers or you know, going solo or, you know, I mean, you know, leaving Fotheringay is a critical point, you know, whether she should have stuck with the group or gone solo, which she chose to do. And the other critical point is whether she should have rejoined Fairport Convention because, as we just talked about, it's not seen as a one of the great creative periods of her in her life. But she did it for the wrong reasons, and I think she did it because she was married to Trevor Lucas by then, and she wanted to be with Trevor, and Trevor had joined Fairport Convention, so you know that was as much a factor in her rejoining as anything else. You know?
Well, it's an interesting life. You know, she made a few albums in her lifetime, and yet there are dozens and dozens of albums available now. People have, you know, basically there's been a mining of, you know, every little artifact that you could find of hers.
Yeah.
And some of that stuff is really worth mining. There's some great...
Oh, God, I mean, I'm a bit wary of, you know... deluxe editions sometimes because the bonus material, particularly sort of home demos, and they're usually the kind of things that you might listen to once because you're kind of intrigued as to how the song started out. But her demos, her home recordings are fantastic.
In many cases, much better than the her demo of The Lady is better than the recording of The Lady.
Yeah, I think there are a number of occasions where because you get the simplicity of the songs and the simplicity of her songwriting, her melodies, and you know she didn't. You know, if anything, a lot of the people that worked with her said this: is that you know she was more confident doing demos or singing live than she was ever in the studio because she. You know, she did have these doubts about her own abilities. So sometimes in the studio, she wouldn't give the best performance. Some of the demos are better or said as good, if not better, than the recorded versions.
Well, you've done a great job of bringing her to life on the page, as I said, and also recreating that. Golden era of the 1960s and 70s. And the book is called I've Always Kept a Unicorn, The Biography of Sandy Denny, the author, my guest, Mick Houghton. Thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
No, thank you.
Well, That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the show, and we'll come back and see us next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to the podcast at iTunes, and you can like us on Facebook. I want to thank my guest, Mick Houghton. His new book is called I've Always Kept a Unicorn, The Biography of Sandy Denny. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas. I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.